here with his first look at what it says in today's papers is John S. Doyle.
There's a great variety of stories on the front pages. The Irish Independent reports that a property investment company, the largest vulture fund in the state, as the writer describes it, has increased the interest rate it charges homeowners, as the huge financial returns these firms expected to reap here fail to materialise. It is an early signal that the vultures themselves are coming under pressure to generate a return, the paper says. The Irish Times leads with a warning by the Economic and Social Research Institute that a sudden drop in corporation tax receipts could cause a prolonged deterioration in the government's finances. The ESRI said that as much as 6 billion euro of the 10 billion corporation tax base could be temporary. The apology by the National Lottery about the exclusion of four top prizes from three scratch card games since 2014 is the main story for the Irish Examiner. The Irish Daily Star reports the arrest in a British prison of a man described as Kinahan cartel boss on charges of conspiracy to import drugs and firearms into the UK and Ireland. The Irish Daily Mirror reports that Gardaí are investigating the sudden death of a newborn baby in the Rotunda Hospital in Dublin. In the Irish Sun's main story, it is reported that the roof of the derelict house in Lucan, County Dublin, where Anna Creagel was murdered last year, is being repaired. Fingal County Council said the works were to protect and stabilise the site. As the paper recalls, the Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, after the murder of Ms. Creagel, said he would like to see Glenwood House's protected status lifted and to have the building demolished. The Taoiseach makes the front page story for the Irish Daily Mail. He has been told he is glib and lacks understanding after reacting to the plight of homeless children by saying Santa would find them. The criticisms came from Fianna Fáil and Labour, amongst others. John O'Sullivan, Labour TD, told the paper that Leo Varadkar really doesn't get how awful it is for children to be in a hotel. A former Taoiseach appears on the front page of The Sun. Bertie Ahern, as chairman of the Bougainville Referendum Commission, declared a landslide vote backing the region's independence from Papua New Guinea. And it provokes some good headlines. Bertie delivers Beau Exit, says The Sun. Bert of a Nation, says The Mail. For the Irish Farmers Journal, the main story is the European Commission's Green Deal announced yesterday. The paper says it has seen leaked Commission draft documents which propose significantly reducing fertiliser use and a cut of between 25% and 50% in pesticides. The Times reports on its front page that a former Irish Naval Service patrol ship, the L.E. Ashling, was sold to a Dutch company and subsequently sold to one of the participants in the civil war in Libya last year, in breach of a UN arms embargo. So the UN Security Council has been told, as Colm Keane reports. Decision day, says the lead headline in the Belfast Telegraph. Up to six Westminster seats could change hands after voters in Northern Ireland go to the polls today, writes Suzanne Breen. The Irish News reports that a group of influential Irish-American politicians, among them Joe Kennedy III, grandson of former US Attorney General Robert Kennedy, have written to the leaders of Britain's three main parties, urging them to ensure that peace in Ireland is not undermined by Brexit. The Times, in an editorial, comments that after a dismal election campaign, British voters face an unenviable choice. The two leading parties are led by deeply flawed men whose failings are compounding the grave, era-defining crisis which Britain faces. Whatever the outcome, the Independent comments, it is likely to have a profound effect on many people on the island of Ireland.
Disgraced Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein has reached a tentative settlement of $25 million with dozens of women who've accused him of sexual misconduct, according to media reports in the US. It's claimed that as part of the deal, Weinstein would not have to admit any wrongdoing and would not have to pay any of the money himself, with his company's insurers paying the bill. Our Washington correspondent Brian O'Donovan tells us more.
Details of this settlement were first reported by the New York Times and have since been picked up by other US media. Now, according to these reports, more than 30 actresses and former Weinstein employees who have accused him of sexual misconduct would share this $25 million payout. Other potential claimants could join in the coming months. The money would not be paid out by Harvey Weinstein personally, but rather it would come from insurance companies representing his movie studio, which is currently going through bankruptcy proceedings. Now, it's understood this would all be part of an overall $47 million settlement designed to close out all of the company's obligations. The deal would not require Harvey Weinstein to admit any wrongdoing. At the moment, it has preliminary approval from most of the parties involved, but it would require final sign-off from all parties and would have to be approved in court. Now, the finer details of the settlement, we understand, are still being worked out. Some of the money would go to cover Harvey Weinstein's own legal costs. Another chunk of the money would be split between 18 alleged victims, with each payout capped at $500,000. A further pot of money would be set aside for other accusers, including any future claimants, with the courts deciding how much should be paid out in each case. Harvey Weinstein has been accused of sexual misconduct by more than 70 women. His accusers include women from Ireland, Britain, Canada, and the US. Also among his alleged victims are some of Hollywood's biggest names, like Gwyneth Paltrow and Angelina Jolie, but it's understood that they are not involved in this legal case that's linked to this proposed settlement. Harvey Weinstein at all times has denied any wrongdoing, insisting that all of the encounters were consensual.
And what's been the reaction of his accusers?
Well, one of his accusers, actress Catherine Kendall, said she was disappointed with the terms of the settlement, but she said she'd agree to it because she didn't want to stop other accusers from receiving payouts. And other accusers have come out, and their lawyers have come out, and the sense seems to be that they are going to go for this deal because they think it's the best thing that's on offer and the best that they're going to get. A lawyer for another claimant said there was a sense that holding out for a better deal might have left the women empty-handed. She said they were in a weakened position because of previous court rulings and previous failed settlement efforts. Some of these lawsuits, Gavin, have been actually going on for about 2 years, and accusers have been disappointed in the past. There was once a promised victims compensation fund of $90 million. That has now dwindled to this current figure of $25 million. Now, not everybody's happy with this, and some of the lawyers have come out strongly objecting to it. Lawyers representing two of Harvey Weinstein's accusers issued a statement last night objecting to the terms of the settlement. They said the deal would pay too much to the lawyers and too little to the victims, and would protect the studio's insurers and boards from future claims. They said that while they don't begrudge any victims who want to settle, they object to any efforts to bind victims who want to hold Harvey Weinstein to account for his actions.
Harvey Weinstein is also facing criminal charges, Brian, and appeared in court yesterday. What happened?
Yeah, that's right. What we've been talking about so far, Gavin, is the civil cases against Harvey Weinstein. But yes, he's also facing criminal charges. Prosecutors have accused him of rape and sexual assault. The alleged offences involved two women and occurred in 2006 and 2013. He's due to go on trial for those offences on January 6th. But he appeared in court yesterday, and Harvey Weinstein looked frail as he appeared outside the courtroom. He was actually using a walking frame, and his lawyer said he was due to undergo back surgery this week. At yesterday's court hearing, the judge doubled Harvey Weinstein's bail from $1 million to $2 million following claims that he had tampered with his electronic ankle monitor. Prosecutors accused him of mishandling the tracking device, causing it to stop transmitting on dozens of occasions over the last 2 months. Now, Harvey Weinstein's lawyers disputed these claims. They insisted that he had not interfered with the ankle monitor and that the problems were technical glitches linked to dead batteries and poor cell phone reception.
Separately, Brian, the US House Judiciary Committee is debating the articles of impeachment against President Donald Trump. Tell us more.
Yeah, so this debate got underway last night. It's the House Judiciary Committee, the next step really in the impeachment process. This involves a debate of those articles of impeachment, the charges facing Donald Trump. Two separate articles, two separate charges, one of abuse of power, the other of obstruction of Congress. That debate got underway last night. It lasted for several hours with different members of the committee making their statements. The debate will resume later on today with all committee members getting their chance to speak. There will then be a vote at committee level to pass these articles of impeachment onto a full House vote that will possibly take place next week. The vote at committee level will pass along party lines, so there's no great surprise or no great expectation that it won't pass. That will mean there will be a full impeachment vote in the House possibly next week, and again, that will probably go along party lines.
That's our Washington correspondent, Brian O'Donovan. It's 20 past seven.
Well, back home, 300 people have been arrested on suspicion of intoxicated driving. And that's just in the last 12 days since the Gardaí's Christmas Road Safety Campaign began. Superintendent Eddie Golden of the Garda National Road Policing Bureau is here. Thanks for coming in. The campaign started Friday the 29th. Right across the country, and big numbers of arrests, much bigger than what you would normally arrest on a weekly basis.
That's correct, Carol, and I suppose our concern, again, to re-emphasise this morning, is that our Christmas campaign started, it's a main focusing on driving while intoxicated, and again, when we looked at our stats just for the first week, and these are just on suspicion of it, they're not convicted yet. However, it tells me that over 300 people have taken a chance to affect their livelihoods, their own safety, and unfortunately, the safety of others on the roads, and that is a concern going into the last 3 weeks of 2019. We're looking at fatalities of 136 at the moment, which are up in this time last year. We've three fatalities moving into the first week of December as well. And look, that is the concern for us. Our main focus is public safety at the end of the day, and we want to re-emphasise that everybody has a responsibility and can have a positive effect on road safety by making the right choices for the next 3 weeks of 2019.
So presumably these arrests on suspicion of intoxication are because somebody has failed a breath test. Tell us about the breakdown between alcohol and drugs and the importance now of drugs in this.
Well, since last year we have a new device which measures the presence of drugs in your system on the roadside, and I suppose that has had a very, I suppose now we're able to measure that far better at the outside of the road. So if somebody we feel has drugs in their system, illegal drugs, or is over a certain limit, we now test them for that on the side of the road. So because of that, I suppose we're able to have a better idea of the difference between the alcohol and drugs, even just at the side of the road. When they go to the station, then they go through a bigger procedure. But over last year, for example, we'd over 1,000 drivers arrested during this same period, during our campaign, for driving while under the influence. Last Christmas Day, we had 11 people arrested for drunk, again, or possible drug driving, and 82 for New Year and New Year's Day. So again, what we're trying to do is, those figures are extremely high, in my view, and we want to just try and mitigate against them.
And can I just ask you, how much of this is because you're out there in greater numbers stopping more cars, or is it because more people are taking the risk at this time of year?
Well, I think it's a combination. Obviously, this is a focus campaign, but for all year round, we have been focusing, obviously, on our checkpoints, and we do the multiple of offences at those. For example, for November, we had 683 instances of driving while intoxicated. So it's not as if it's just for December now. This focus is on Garda Síochána or out there all over the country. We have our mandatory intoxicating checkpoints all over at different times, and it's a 24-hour campaign on a daily basis. So there is no good time that you think you're going to get away with this. And again, looking forward for the next couple of weeks, what we are is emphasising is our message is that ultimately we want everybody never ever drink or drug drive. Book a taxi, use public transport, and you know, nominate a designated driver.
And particularly late at night, because 75% of deaths are alcohol related between what times?
Yes, between the hours of 10 p.m. and 6 a.m. Alcohol, the RSA have done research on this, and so this is not, we're trying to actually point out to people that, you know, during this period, particularly in the early hours of the morning, there is a propensity for people to have take a chance with intoxication. Can I also stress as well, it's not just drivers, it's vulnerable road users as well. That includes pedestrians. So if you're a pedestrian or if you're taking a chance of walking home, what we're asking people to do is make plans. We do all the plans about the Christmas party, but do we do the plan of how we're going to get home
safely? Getting home, exactly. Okay, Superintendent Eddie Golden of the Garda National Road Policing Bureau, thanks for bringing us up to date with that.
The National Lottery has apologised after leaving off four promised top prizes worth a total of €180,000 from some of its scratch card games. The card games affected were Congratulations and Diamond Bingo Doubler. For one of the Congratulations games, there should have been four cards for sale with prizes of €50,000, but there were only two. In another congratulations game, there should have been two cards with prizes of €50,000, but there was only one. And on the Diamond Bingo Doubler cards, there should have been four cards for sale with prizes of €30,000, but there were only three. That means that people who bought the cards had a lot less chance of winning a top prize than they were told. The lottery say the problems date back 5 years, were caused by human error, and that they found out 6 weeks ago following an internal review, but only removed the games this week. Callers to Liveline yesterday weren't happy.
They were selling tickets to people who thought they had a chance of winning X amount of money, but they didn't. And now they're saying, sorry about that, we'll withdraw them today. We knew about it 6 weeks ago, but if you want to go into another draw...
If you look at the National Lottery website, they give you a list of the prizes that are available under each scratch card game. And invariably, halfway through when the timeline of those scratch cards, you will see that all the major prizes have probably been won, and that people are still buying cards on the basis that those prizes are still available.
That money should immediately be divided up between a number of charities. There is no way it should go back into a pot for the company running the lotto to make more money.
Callers to Liveline yesterday. Pierce Doherty is here. He's Sinn Féin finance spokesperson. Pierce Doherty, thank you very much for coming in to us. What's your understanding of what happened here?
I think it's a very, very serious issue. What we have is we have three different games, which, you know, resulted in a turnover of about €30 million for this private company, which now operates our National Lottery. In my view, should never have been sold, and we never had an issue with it before it went into private hands. So we have a situation where, out of a total of about 1.5 million cards that were printed in these three games that had prizes associated with them, there was four cards that weren't printed, and those four cards just happened to be cards not with a €3 prize or a €5 prize, but the four cards included the top prizes. I think it's deeply suspicious that there were the four out of the 1.5 million cards that were left out in error. I think that the fact that this company continued to allow people to buy the National Lottery tickets, a certain scratch card that was in sale up until this week, knowing that the prize fund structure was not in compliance with what was being approved by the regulator. I think there's also serious questions in relation to the regulator. We have a regulator with a team of about 10 staff that only regulates one company. That they told us when she came before the finance committee that she has a huge amount of access to all the data, to all the management companies. She has real time access to all lottery tickets that are actually sold. Yet it wasn't the regulator that uncovered this error.
The Office of the Regulator was not available for interview. They said in a statement, "My officials are now examining what breaches of the Act or licence may have occurred and have written to the operator to commence the formal process prescribed in the licence in this regard." In a statement, the National Lottery said these omissions were discovered through an internal review of all National Lottery products over the last 6 weeks and were caused by human error. Do we know why they did this review? Like, how do they know there was a problem in the first place?
Well, it seems that they're...
Why do they do a review?
They haven't answered that, and I think it's, what we have is, and again, in my view, we have a relationship between the regulator and the company where they have agreed now to carry out another draw where they will allow for the 180,000 that they didn't pay out in prizes to be won over the Christmas period. In my view, that's completely and utterly inappropriate. It provides a benefit to the company, which will result in higher draws and more publicity and so on for the company. We understand from their statement, which is quite brief, that this was an internal review, but there are serious questions. If you look at one of the scratch cards, they sold 4 million tickets, 975,000 of those tickets had prizes in it, and one of those, the one that was missing, was the top prize. Now that happened in the last number of weeks, but we also have a situation where the same thing happened a couple of years ago and again happened during the same period. So it is deeply suspicious that this has happened on three occasions, and it is always the top prize that has been left out. But we charge the regulator to protect us, to protect the National Lottery, because it is ours at the end of the day, even though it's been sold on licence. And I believe that office has completely failed in this regard.
Almost 7:30, and I'll get to news headlines shortly. Total sales from the National Lottery, the last sales that we had, there were over €800 million in a year, which... is a lot of gambling, frankly. Part of this license agreement, and I know it isn't the case in these games because there was a problem, but if there are any prizes which aren't claimed, those monies go back to the company, which they are not allowed to claim as profits, but they have to use for marketing processes or something like that. But in Britain, if there are unclaimed prizes, they go into good causes. Why is there the difference here?
I think there's a serious flaw with the legislation. That's one of the areas where the company can use the unclaimed prizes, which is about 2% of all prizes.
71 million over the last 3 or 4 years, I think.
And they're able to basically use that in additional marketing for the company. And this company, this private company, has increased the footprint of the National Lottery in a huge way. You see a 64% increase in the number of outlets, nearly over 2,000 more outlets that are selling scratch cards and National Lottery since they came in. There is huge amount of advertising from outside the shop, inside the shop, TV screens, you know, it's there in your face beside the sweets racks for children and all the rest. They are taking out games, for example, Lucky Ducks and all the rest, that in my view are targeted at children and not at adults. And the legislation is deeply flawed because indeed the code of conducts that the regulator has to abide by and the company has to abide by are actually written and drafted by the company themselves and sent to the regulator. So I think it's time to revisit all of this, these issues.
Piers Doherty, Sinn Féin finance spokesperson, thank you for coming into us this morning.
Let's get the business heads from Brian Finn.
Thanks, Carol. Around 1,400 clients of the collapsed investment firm Custom House Capital are facing further delays in receiving compensation. It's because of a High Court case being taken by the state's investor compensation company. It's seeking legal clarification about an aspect of its statutory powers. The liquidator to Custom House Capital has been prevented from distributing funds while the case is ongoing. The Kerry-based financial services provider Fexco is expanding its retail foreign exchange presence in the UK. It's rolling out another 50 money-changing outlets at Morrison's stores across Britain. It has a 12% share of the UK retail foreign exchange market at the moment. And it could be a busy day for those seeking to change sterling at a retail and professional trading level. The pound has been fairly volatile in the last 24 hours ahead of polling in the British general election. Against the euro, the pound has varied from 84 to 84 and a half pence since yesterday morning. Right now, the euro is trading at 84.3 pence and $1.114.
Sports News Des Cahill is here. Morning, Des.
Good morning. We're starting with news of a plan to split the FAI in two, which is to be put to the government. The proposal, devised by FAI staff members, suggests that the state would fund a new body that would solely govern grassroots and community football, and the FAI would look after the international teams and elite football. The plan suggests the government provide €10 million to fund the grassroots, while the FAI would fund itself through commercial deals. Currently, the government invests just under €3 million on soccer. Now, the lineup for the last 16 of the Champions League is complete after last night's group stages concluded. Tottenham had already made sure of their place before losing 3-1 to Bayern Munich in Germany. Dublin teenager Troy Parrott was named on the bench but did not play for Spurs. Another newcomer, Ryan Sessegnon, scored the Tottenham goal. They go through in second place from their group. Here's their manager, Jose Mourinho.
From the teams that finish second, I think the teams that finish first, they wish they don't play against us. I think we are one of the strongest teams from the second group. I know that we are a country that goes to a crazy period, which many, many times leaves marks on players, on teams, on condition. But by the end of February, I understand my players better, they understand me better.
In Group C, Gabriel Jesus hit a hat-trick as Manchester City wrapped up their group campaign with a 4-1 win at Dinamo Zagreb. They go through as group winners, and Pep Guardiola is upbeat about their chances.
We make 70 good minutes, especially second half, and the players don't play regularly, play incredible well, and it's good. So now focus in the Premier League and the other competitions and wait in which conditions we arrive in February. In good spirit to face the best teams in Europe.
In the same group, Atalanta secured qualification to the last 16. Despite having lost their first three games in the group, no team has ever come through that before. The Italian side, who are competing in the Champions League for the first time, had only 1 point after four games, but they won their last two games, including last night's 3-0 win at Shakhtar Donetsk, to cap off a remarkable recovery. In Group D, Atletico Madrid became the last team to qualify. They got the 2-0 win in Lokomotiv Moscow that they needed to make sure of their progress. In the English Championship, West Brom missed the chance to go top of the table. They drew 1-1 at struggling Wigan. Brentford moved to within a point of the playoffs with a hard-fought 2-1 win over Cardiff. It's a busy night in the Europa League tonight. Several clubs have already qualified for the knockout stages, including Celtic, who play Cluj, Manchester United, who host AZ Alkmaar, and Wolves at home to Besiktas. Arsenal need to avoid a heavy defeat against Standard Liège, and Rangers need a draw with Young Boys of Bern. In rugby, Munster back row Arna Bolta will miss the game at Saracens this weekend after receiving a 3-game ban for his red card in last Saturday's game. And finally, for now, golf news, and the President's Cup is underway in Melbourne. The international team has taken a 4-1 lead against the USA. Tiger Woods and Justin Thomas provided the only point for the US.
Well, if you're planning on leaving out a beverage for Santa this Christmas Eve in the Greater Dublin area, maybe don't make it a glass of water. Irish Water is appealing to all in the region, and that includes parts of Kildare, Meath and Wicklow, to be mindful of the use of water over the Christmas period. Now, this comes only weeks after around 600,000 people in Dublin had to boil their water due to quality issues. Well, Tom Cuddy from Irish Water is joined us in studio. Thank you very much, Tom, for coming in.
Carol.
What's the problem now?
Well, essentially in the Greater Dublin area, the supply-demand balance for drinking water is on the line. Our production capacity has reduced somewhat, and there's an inexorable increase in demand from households and from businesses as we come through the winter.
So there are more homes, more businesses using more water, and you simply don't have enough of it. Why is this?
Well, essentially this is a narrowing gap, the headroom between what we can produce and what's demanded. And that has narrowed even further this year. And in particular, our production capacity has been reduced because we have constrictions at some of our treatment plants, in particular leak slip, as you'd be aware. We're keen to raise people's awareness about this. You know, it's very important that people are aware that they conserve water where they can, that they check their plumbing, and that they report leaks.
So there is works going on at the leak slip plant, we know that, mm-hmm. and they're not due to be completed until the middle of next year. So are we really looking at sort of a rolling warning until then over the consumption of water, or is this a specific issue related to these couple of weeks?
Well, it's a combination, but absolutely, you're right there, Carol, that it is a rolling issue. It's an enduring situation that we'll have for several months. While we have ramped back the treatment plant in order to give ourselves the capacity to do the upgrade works, it means that we have a constraint on our capacity at leak slip, and that obviously reflects across the entire Dublin region, because our other plants are all at their max at this stage to make up the balance.
And since that problem was identified a few weeks ago, you're doing the works, but in the broader picture, what has been done to make the whole system fit for purpose?
Well, there's a huge amount of work going on all of the time. In the short term, we've reconfigured the network so that we can get the maximum from all of our plants, so that there's water distributed everywhere. We have ongoing big investment in leakage reduction. We're repairing 1,500 leaks per month at the moment. There's a lot of upgrade works, including what's happening at leak slip and elsewhere. And all of these works will help to reinforce and strengthen and improve the capacity and security of the network and of the plants.
And leaks continue to be a huge problem. You want people to look out for leaks, and also the whole issue of burst pipes as the weather gets colder. That can really knock you back.
Well, certainly both ourselves and the public and householders and business owners need to be winter ready and winter aware. There are the obvious winter challenges of cold weather. There's also, as we find at this time of year, there's an increase in demand in customer use, particularly in businesses. And there's a lot that people can do to safeguard themselves and to keep an eye out and report leaks.
Okay, and are we expecting any kind of crisis over the Christmas period, or are you just kind of preparing for what might happen?
Well, essentially the situation is right on the line, but it's stable as it is now. Occasionally we have had crises.
Stable but critical, it sounds like.
Well, indeed, because we don't have headroom in the event of some event, a very sharp and prolonged frost, for example.
Okay, so everybody needs to be mindful of their use of water then.
Well, in households, workplaces, to use less, but also if premises are vacant, the people check the plumbing, they make sure that they check their tanks, outside taps and so on, so that the risk of bursts, people don't want to come back to a ceiling having come down or a floor having come up.
And you're recommending leave a bit of heat on if you're leaving your house for a week at Christmas, a low-level heat?
Oh, for sure. Like burst pipes within a building can cause a lot of trouble indeed.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Tom Cuddy from Irish Water, thanks for joining us. It's 7:45.
We're going to New Zealand next, where police say they now have a plan to recover the bodies of those killed by a volcanic eruption on White Island on Monday. The remains of at least 8 people are still thought to be on the island. 8 others have already been confirmed dead, and 20 people are in intensive care after suffering severe burns when the volcano erupted as tourists were visiting. Lisette Raymer is a news reporter with MediaWorks in New Zealand. She's at the Bay of Plenty, that's on the mainland, about 50 kilometres away from the volcano. Lisette, good morning.
Good morning.
And thank you for taking our call. Up until now, it's been considered far too dangerous for anybody to go to the island to try to recover these bodies, but authorities say they now plan to do just that. What's the plan?
Well, that is exactly right. And to be honest, that danger has not gone away. If anything, it's actually increased. So initially, after the first eruption, they said that within the next 24 hours, there would be no chance or little to no chance of another eruption. Now there is 60% chance of another eruption within the next 24 hours. So if anything, the risk has got greater. But because it's constantly increasing, they've decided that they need to strike now or the window will close for good, and they're going to do their best to mitigate those risks, although they're being very transparent about the fact that it's not a zero risk operation. So tomorrow at first light, they will set out a team of 8 onto the island, and they've given themselves the balance of the morning, so around 2.5-3 hours to fly in. They'll have a vessel with them as well. They're not going into details about who will retrieve the bodies and how they will get back, but we know they have a Navy vessel, and they also have some helicopters as part of this operation. There's 8 members of the team. They will go in and they will do their best to retrieve their bodies. But what we've learned in this last press conference is that although they know there are 8 bodies on the island, or there are 8 people still unaccounted for, they can only see 6 of them in the satellite imagery. So they know where 6 are, they do not know where the other 2 are.
So they know where to find 6 of them, but they're still looking for the other 2. What are the families of the victims that are still on the island saying?
Oh, well, you can imagine there is immense relief today to have some progress. I was speaking to one of the victims' brothers today, and he had essentially lost hope completely, he said, because of the red tape that New Zealand police have, or most authorities operate in. He just didn't see a time where they would consider the risk fair enough to put other people's lives at risk to save or retrieve, 8 bodies. So the idea that now finally, yes, they have decided that it is worth it to get these loved ones back to their families, that's a huge relief. But there is so much to go before those bodies are home. There are concerns about the weather turning. There are concerns, obviously, about the volcanic activity. There are concerns about the magma. So there's a long way to go, but relief, obviously.
Lisa, tell me about the people who survived the eruption, many of whom are in a very difficult condition in hospital.
Exactly. That's the other thing, is that there were 32 people taken off the island, taken to hospital. We know that 6 of them died, or 5 of them died initially, then another died in hospital on the first night. Then this morning, New Zealand time, another 2 passed away in hospital because of these burns. They are extensive injuries. A lot of people remain in critical condition. New Zealand has ordered in 1.2 million centimetres squared of skin grafts from the United States to help these
survivors. They're ordering in skin from abroad.
They are. And a lot of the Australian survivors have now been sent back to Australia to be looked after in their burns units. To put it in perspective, the hospital in New Zealand that received a lot of these patients dealt with a year's worth of work in one day. In that one day, they dealt with a year's worth of work in that burn unit. So they are extensive injuries. And sadly, these survivors who came off the island are still fighting for their lives, and that could take years for them to get back to the lives they were living before they set off for that amazing day trip.
Lisette, thank you very much for speaking to us. That's Lisette Raymer. She's a news reporter with MediaWorks in New Zealand.
Brian Finn has the business news.
Thanks, Carl. It's a significant day ahead for equity and currency markets. The pound is fairly steady this morning ahead of the UK general election. Euro watchers will have their sights firmly trained on the European Central Bank today, where Christine Lagarde will preside over her first monetary policy meeting as ECB president. To take a look at these issues, Gerard Keegan, senior treasury dealer at Investec, is here. And if I recall correctly, Gerard, Mario Draghi hit the ground running. I think he cut rates on his first day in the job. Christine Lagarde is hardly likely to be as active, is she?
Unlikely, I would say. Yeah, absolutely. Mario Draghi's first act was he had to reverse two rate hikes from his predecessor, Jean-Claude Trichet, 10 years ago, whereas he has just cut rates in September, so he's done a lot of the heavy lifting for Christine Lagarde, and the expectation is that he's kind of directed her focus elsewhere. She's not going to have to persuade the ECB Council to cut rates as her first act, but he has left her a task to perhaps persuade the major economies in Europe to loosen the spending ties and spend more freely in their budgets.
So he's predetermined her path in many ways, but I suppose the thing for Christine Lagarde is that she has to consult her committee, and it's divided, to use the monetary parlance, it's divided between hawks and doves. The hawks are the ones who are less likely to want to cut interest rates. In fact, they'll want to increase interest rates. So what has she got ahead of her?
That's correct, and actually if you look at the composition of the Board of Governors, Mario Draghi was probably mindful of the changes every year, and obviously with Draghi stepping down, he was a big proponent of rate cuts, and two other board members, Benoit Coeur and forget the names, are leaving, who would have been big proponents of rate cuts and being replaced possibly by more neutral members. So the support possibly might not have been there for Christine Lagarde to enact these rate cuts if he hadn't done it in October. So the other important fact is he cut rates it was a consensus decision, but there was opposition, and shortly after the rate cuts were announced, Sabine Lautenschlager, who's the German representative on the Board of Governors, resigned in protest. So certainly there is opposition there, and Christine Lagarde's job might be one of bridge building to re-establish a consensus at the ECB.
And Germany is particularly against interest rate cuts. Why is that?
They've a particular aversion to inflation, and I suppose that the whole purpose of interest rate cut has been to promote inflation now, albeit to a moderate target of 2%. Obviously, with Germany's history, they've seen hyperinflation, so there is a fear there. They've another fear of very loose fiscal spending as well. So these two fears have kind of put them at loggerheads with the ECB's policy at the moment. Particularly during Draghi's tenure, he was often arguing with the German representatives on the board in terms of how and how often and how aggressively to cut rates. For Christine Lagarde, it could be how hard do they push for looser spending from the European governments.
I mentioned the British election at the outset. It's going to be a long day and a night for currency traders. The pound has been at a 2.5-year high against the euro in recent days. Now, their traders are banking on a particular outcome, that is a conservative majority. What if that doesn't come about?
Conservative majority is pretty much priced in. The polling recently, only in the last 2 days, has shown it might not be as sure a thing. Boris is still on track to win somewhat of a majority. That polls are showing between maybe 5 and 15% ahead. That was 10 to 20% ahead last week. We think if he gets a comfortable, maybe 40-50 seat majority, that'll be moderately sterling positive, but any other outcome, a narrow majority or even a hung parliament, which would be disastrous, would be sterling negative. And a hung parliament in particular, there's no natural government that we see could be formed. Even a Remain coalition looks very difficult, so we could see a return to the high 88p and possibly even 90p levels, particularly given the end of January deadline for passing his withdrawal bill.
So that would be a massive swing, because we're at about 84p at the moment, so to go to 90p would be a big swing in a day.
It would. I mean, even without the Brexit deadline, if you look at previous hung parliaments back at Theresa May in 2017, which is the last time euro sterling was around these levels, just before that election, and even further back when David Cameron was forced to go into government with the Lib Dems. Both of those hung parliaments without the added pressure of a Brexit deadline saw sterling weaken by 3-4%. You add on the tight timelines in terms of getting a deal agreed by the end of January, we certainly think it could be 7-8%, which would...
And a Labour government, something similar?
Well, a Labour government, we just don't see how it could be formed given the opposition to the between the different Remain parties, that the policies are too different. We don't think Jeremy Corbyn will get enough seats to form a government. If he does, he's not popular in markets either. I mean, the prospect of him maybe delivering a second referendum would give some hope further down the line, but a Corbyn-led Labour government is not attractive to markets.
Gerald Keegan of Investec, thank you very much indeed. More business news at 8:30 now. It's back to Gavin.
It's 8:04. Let's get a weather forecast. Siobhan Ryan is at Met Air. Morning, Siobhan.
Good morning, Gavin. Well, it's a generally wet start out there now with outbreaks of rain for a time. And whilst it will brighten up through the morning, blustery, heavy showers will also move in from the west with a risk of hail and thunder, some of those turning prolonged later, particularly across Atlantic counties. I'm feeling cold today. Highs of only 5-9, and that's in a strengthening westerly wind. So windy in turn tonight with scattered showers, frequent over Ulster and North Connacht, with the ongoing risk of hail and thunder. Some frost is possible too, though mainly just for sheltered spots, with overnight lows of 1-5. Now we'll stay windy into tomorrow Friday with sunshine and heavy showers. The focus of the showers will be over Ulster and North Leinster in the morning, mainly confined to Ulster in the afternoon. During the evening then, heavy showers will move into Atlantic counties. Highs tomorrow then, 5-8, and feeling even colder with an added wind chill factor that's in a fresh to strong and gusty westerly wind. And colder again this weekend with well below normal temperatures and bitterly cold conditions after dark with frost and ice. Saturday will feel raw. Again, we're looking at brisk westerly winds with bright winter sunshine and well scattered wintry showers. Highs on Saturday of only 3-6. And on Sunday, we're looking at similar temperatures with some lying snow possible to begin the day, mainly over parts of the west and the north midlands. And once again, we'll see sunshine and well scattered wintry showers through the day. Today then, in brief, outbreaks of rain this morning with sunny spells and blustery heavy showers later with a risk of hail and thunder. Feeling cold today, afternoon highs of 5-9, and that's in a strengthening westerly breeze. That's all for me for the moment. A very good morning.
The news is read by Brian Jennings.
Voting is underway in the UK's third general election in less than 5 years. More than 46 million people in England, Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland are eligible to cast their ballots in what the main British party leaders say is one of the most significant electoral contests in decades. The latest opinion polls suggest the race between the Conservatives, led by Prime Minister Boris Johnson, and Jeremy Corbyn's main opposition Labour Party has tightened. From London, Dimitri O'Donnell reports.
After 5 weeks of campaigning, Boris Johnson ended by promising to deliver Brexit by the 31st of January. Jeremy Corbyn said Labour offered a vote for hope. The Liberal Democrat leader Jo Swinson told supporters it was possible to deny Boris Johnson a majority through tactical voting. The SNP's Nicola Sturgeon published a letter calling Boris Johnson the greatest danger to Scotland in modern times. Polls close at 10 o'clock tonight. In 24 hours, we should know which side will form Britain's next government. Dimitri O'Donnell, RTE News, London.
There'll be coverage of the UK election results across all RT platforms beginning tonight. Television coverage will include the exit poll on prime time at 10 p.m. and the first results as they come in from 11 p.m. on RT1. The Taoiseach Leo Varadkar will join other EU leaders for a two-day summit in Brussels, which gets underway this afternoon. Although Brexit is not on the agenda until tomorrow, leaders are expected to keep a close eye on the first results of the UK general election tonight. From Brussels, our Europe editor Tony Connolly.
Officials have been keen to stress that the summit is about the EU's bold new plan to be climate neutral by 2050, but Brexit will never be far from the minds of leaders when the first exit polls roll in around 11 p.m. Brussels time. Should Boris Johnson win a comfortable majority, then it will have been the last ever EU summit with Britain as a member. In any event, Johnson will be represented at the summit by Charles Michel, the new European Council president, who's taken over from Donald Tusk. Michelle has urged leaders to embrace the new European Commission plan for Europe to be the first climate-neutral continent by 2050. Eastern European countries like Poland, Hungary and the Czech Republic are pushing for more money from the EU budget to offset the cost of transitioning from coal dependency to low-carbon economies, but they will face resistance from net contributors. Tony Connolly, RTE News, Brussels.
The Economic and Social Research Institute has warned that any reduction in windfall levels of corporation tax will have a significant impact on the public finances. In its quarterly report on the economy, the ESRI also forecasts that growth in the economy will moderate next year to 3.3%. Our economics correspondent Robert Short.
This has been another year of strong growth in the economy. The ESRI expects that growth to continue next year, but not at the same pace. That's because Europe's economy has slowed down and international disputes have hit trade. And then there's Brexit. The ESRI says any future trade negotiations between the EU and the UK could lead to friction between European states as different interests compete. This could add to the uncertainty facing firms. The think tank also warns that any sudden reversal in windfall levels of corporation tax will open a big hole in the public finances. This could require the government to implement austerity policies. Because of this danger, it advises that the windfall portion of the corporation tax take should be set aside to counter any shocks to the economy in the future.
The Doyle's Ethics Watchdog, the Committee on Members' Interests, will meet this morning to consider a complaint made against the former Fine Gael TD Dara Murphy over his attendance record and expenses claims. The committee will also continue with its separate investigation into Fianna Fáil TDs accused of voting for colleagues who were outside the chamber. Our political correspondent Paul Cunningham.
Earlier this month, Fine Gael's Dara Murphy resigned his seat as TD for Cork North Central to take up a new role in the European Commission. He tendered his letter of resignation to the Laskeown Coirle, Pathacope Gallagher, minutes after supporting Housing Minister Owen Murphy in a vote of no confidence. However, Fianna Fáil's whip Michael Moynihan has questioned if Mr Murphy breached ethics legislation by claiming allowances despite being largely absent from Doyle proceedings for 2 years while working with the European People's Party. Given Mr Murphy is no longer a TD, it seems likely that the Doyle's Members' Interest Committee will forward Deputy Moynihan's complaint to the Committee on Procedures and Privileges, which in turn will request the Clerk of the Doyle, Peter Finnegan, to draft a report. Meanwhile, the Doyle's Ethics Watchdog is also set to continue with its investigation into a complaint from Fine Gael TD Noel Rock, as well as a member of the public, into voting irregularities by Fianna Fáil TDs in the Doyle Chamber.
At least one person died every day in 2017 due to a drug overdose, according to the latest figures from the Health Research Board. A cocktail of drugs contributed to 3 in 5 of those deaths. Alcohol continues to be the main contributing factor. Tommy Meskell reports.
Alcohol contributed to roughly one-third of all overdose deaths in 2017, and 61 people died from alcohol poisoning alone. As they reveal their latest figures, the Health Research Board say that of the 376 people who died from a drug overdose in 2017, 3 out of 5 had consumed a cocktail of drugs. This can lead to complications, according to the HRB, and increase the risk of fatal overdose. Many of those who died in 2017 were men, typically in their 30s or 40s. Prescribable drugs were used in 2/3 of overdose deaths. The data also shows that cocaine-related poisoning continues to rise, from 42 deaths in 2016 to 53 in 2017.
Now the time is exactly 7 minutes past 8.
RTE Radio 1 weather with ESB Networks. Working on a construction site? Stay clear of overhead wires and underground cables. For emergencies, call 1850 372 999.
Outbreaks of rain this morning with sunny spells and blustery heavy showers later with the risk of hail and thunder. Feeling cold with highest temperatures 5 to 9 degrees. There's a warning that westerly winds will increase to gale force later today on coasts from Carnshore Point to Loophead to Bloody Foreland.
John S. Doyle is back with his look at what it says in the papers.
The Irish Independent reports that a property investment company, the largest vulture fund in the state, as the writer describes it, has increased the interest rate it charges homeowners. The huge financial returns these firms expected to reap here are failing to materialise, the paper says. The Irish Times leads with a warning by the Economic and Social Research Institute that a sudden drop in corporation tax receipts could cause a prolonged deterioration in the government's finances. The apology by the National Lottery about the exclusion of four top prizes from three scratch card games since 2014 is the main story for the Irish Examiner. The Irish Daily Star reports the arrest in a British prison of a man described as Kinahan cartel boss on charges of conspiracy to import drugs and firearms into the UK and Ireland. The Irish Daily Mirror reports that Gardaí are investigating the sudden death of a newborn baby in the Rotunda Hospital in Dublin. In the Irish Sun's main story, it is reported that the roof of the derelict house in Lucan, County Dublin, where Anna Creagel was murdered last year, is being repaired. Fingal County Council said that works were to protect and stabilise the site. As the paper recalls, the Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, after the murder of Miss Creagel, said he would like to see Glenwood House's protected status lifted and to have the building demolished. The Taoiseach is the subject of the Irish Daily Mail's lead story. He has been told he is glib and lacks understanding after reacting to the plight of homeless children by saying Santa would find them. The criticisms come from Fianna Fáil and Labour, amongst others. John O'Sullivan, Labour TD, is quoted as saying that Leo Varadkar really doesn't get how awful it is for children to be in a hotel. For the Irish Farmers Journal, the main story is the European Commission's Green Deal, announced yesterday. The paper says it has seen leaked Commission draft documents which propose significantly reducing the use of fertilisers and a cut of between 25% and 50% in pesticides. The Times reports on its front page that a former Irish Naval Service patrol ship, the L.E. Ashling, was sold to one of the participants in the civil war in Libya last year in breach of a UN arms embargo. Colm Keane explains that according to a UN Security Council report, the state sold the offshore patrol vessel for €110,000 to a Dutch shipping broker. That company sold it a year later for €473,000 to a company in the United Arab Emirates, which almost immediately sold it to a company in Libya for €1.3 million. Decision day, says the lead headline in the Belfast Telegraph. Up to six Westminster seats could change hands after voters in Northern Ireland go to the polls today, writes Suzanne Breen. The Irish News reports that a group of influential Irish-American politicians has written to the leaders of Britain's three main parties, urging them to ensure that peace in Ireland is not undermined by Brexit. The Times, in an editorial, comments that after a dismal election campaign, British voters face an unenviable choice. Whatever the outcome, the Examiner says, it is likely to have a profound effect on many people on the island of Ireland.
In August, the lives of Elaine and Johnny Downey were turned upside down when their only son, Jack, died after taking a substance at the Independence Music Festival. Jack, a 19-year-old accounting student, passionate about GAA, was remembered fondly by his parents at his funeral mass as the star of his family. Within weeks of his passing, Elaine and Johnny spoke publicly about the need for other parents to talk to their children about the danger of drugs. Today, the Health Research Board released their latest figures for 2017. They show that at least one person died from a drug poisoning every day that year. Last night, Johnny Downing spoke to our reporter Tommy Meskell. Johnny began by explaining what happened on August Bank Holiday weekend.
On the 2nd of August, this year, Jack attended the Independence Festival in Mitchelstown. He had been there the previous year. He left here at 10:30 Friday morning, and we received a phone call 9 o'clock that night to get down to Cork University Hospital as soon as possible. 10:30 that morning was the last time I spoke to Jack.
That last conversation that you had with him, can you remember what he was saying to you?
Yeah, he was going out that morning, and I said, Jack, just be careful and don't get into any trouble. And he said, "Ah, sure, Dad, I was there last year." I said, as if he was a veteran of going to concerts, it would have been his second.
It's one mistake, Johnny, as you've said yourself. It's one mistake, but the consequences are catastrophic.
Absolutely. As I said, like, you know, I had never any fears of Jack taking this, whatever it was, at this concert. It seems to be parcel of young people's lives of, you know, just taking a chance. But it cost Jack and us, or the ultimate price.
The reason we speak to you today is because the Health Research Board are releasing their latest figures. Those figures show that 376 people died from an overdose in 2017. That's more than one person every single day. So you and your wife, Elaine, have said that it's time for parents to have a conversation with their children about drug use, because this is just becoming such a major issue.
Yeah, I mean, like, as I said, it's something that it affects, as we now know, and I always knew, I suppose, it affects every walk of life. It doesn't differentiate. I suppose I wouldn't call Jack's an overdose in a sense, because he did never have taken a drug before in his life. The young man wasn't even able to take an anodyne. We have gone to schools and we have done a few talks in relation to what has happened in our life. And we're hoping that somebody took note we were saying in relation to it. It's not a campaign or a martyrdom or anything else like that. It's just it's our story. But unfortunately, you have the figures there. It's a lot of other families who won't be sitting around a Christmas table this year.
And finally, just on that, Johnny, if I could ask you, Christmas is just around the corner. Speaking to us via WhatsApp, and you said to me earlier that Jack actually set it up on your phone. So I suppose that shows just how recent this is. It was only August. How have you been? How have yourself and Elaine been?
Well, we're devastated. I mean, we've been blessed with great friends, family, colleagues. But ultimately, I suppose, at night time, weird ones in closed doors, and our life is just devastated. We have to get used to a new normal now. It's not a normal, but it is what we have to face, and we'll have to face it for the rest of our lives together. But we couldn't have got this far without friends and colleagues and everyone who well wishes. I mean, there must be 5,000 cards and letters here in the house from people from all over the country. So it has had a profound effect. So hopefully something positive will come out of all this.
That was Johnny Downing talking to our reporter Tommy Mescal last night. Ina Lynn is here. She's a research officer at the Health Research Board. And as we've been hearing, her research shows that at least one person a day dies from a drug poisoning, the latest data put together from deaths in 2017. Ina, thank you very much for coming in to us. I know you can't talk specifically about Jack Downey's case, and it wouldn't fall in to the category of these numbers, and we don't know the drug that was responsible for Jack's death. But when we talk about overdoses, or to be more precise, poisoning, it's irrespective of how much of the drug was taken in some cases. It may be a small amount, it may be too much, but in all cases that you're looking at, it is the drug that's responsible for somebody's death. Isn't that right?
Well, first of all, Gavin, I'd like to sympathise with the Downey family on their tragic loss of their son, Jack. I am a parent myself, and I actually have a son by the name of Jack, and I can't even begin to imagine their grief. And as Johnny said, unfortunately, himself and Elaine are not alone. There are many families across this country that have lost loved ones due to deaths. Not only parents, but also siblings and young children. Because the majority of these people that have died are in their 30s and 40s. So there are young children that have lost parents due to these deaths. And in fact, there's no county in Ireland that hasn't been affected by these deaths. And as you said, rightly said, there's 376 overdose deaths reported by the Health Research Board in 2017. And that equates to at least one death day for that year. And the majority of these deaths are due to people taking a cocktail of drugs. In fact, cocktail of drugs contribute to 3 in 5 of our poisoning deaths. And when we talk about a cocktail of drugs, we're talking about people taking a number of drugs at the same time. For example, if somebody takes alcohol with methadone and Valium, these drugs have similar side effects on the body. So if you're taking a multitude of drugs, and we see that people are increasing the amount of drugs they're taking, you're multiplying those side effects on the body. And one of those side effects, for example, would be a decrease in your breathing, relaxed breathing. So if you're taking 3 or 4 drugs that have the same side effects, you're going to contribute to decreasing that breathing more, which will result in less oxygen going to your body. And unfortunately, as this data from the Health Research Board shows, too often that results in death.
Tell us about the most common drugs responsible.
The most common drugs are what we call prescribable drugs. But what's important to point out here that these drugs, which are mainly methadone, Valium, Xanax, they are very important and very beneficial for a number of medical conditions when they are taken under medical supervision, as prescribed by your doctor and as directed by your pharmacist. But it is when they are misused or taken as part of a cocktail outside of medical supervision that they can be fatal.
Alcohol?
Alcohol has contributed to 1 in 3 poison deaths in Ireland in 2017. And while we actually have seen a decrease in the number of poison deaths where alcohol has been involved, it still remains the main single drug implicated in poison deaths in Ireland, either on its own or as part of a cocktail of drugs. And as I mentioned, it's commonly used with other CNS depressant drugs such as methadone and Valium. And this is contributing to the cocktail of drugs which caused too many fatalities in Ireland.
Tell me about the role of illicit drugs or illegal drugs.
Well, what we're seeing in 2017 is an increase in cocaine poisoning deaths and MDMA poisoning deaths, commonly known as ecstasy. And what's important to point out here is in relation to cocaine, it mirrors our economy in Ireland. We saw a peak in cocaine poisoning deaths in 2017, similar to the Celtic Tiger time, followed by a decline.
But 2007, sorry, was it?
From 2007,
yes.
That was the highest number in 2007. And then it declined, similar to our economy. But since 2010, we have seen a steady increase in poison deaths involving cocaine, corresponding to our increase in our economy. And what we do know from recent EU drug market report that was released this month, there is an increased supply of illicit drugs in the market, and not only that, but their potency is stronger. So there's more drugs around and they are stronger drugs.
I'm just looking at your research, which also looks at the trends over the last decade or so, and you mentioned going back to 2007. Overall, the number of people who are dying as a result of drug poisoning, it's remained relatively stable. It's high, but it isn't hugely increased over that time. The one difference that I do note is that the average age of the people who are dying is getting older.
Yes, we have seen over the trending period a fluctuation year on year on drug poison deaths, but you're right to say there's been no significant increase or decrease in drug poison deaths over that time period. And we are seeing an older cohort of people who've died as a result of poison deaths. And we are also seeing this in relation to our cohort of people who are looking for treatment for problematic drug use. And you must remember that some of these deaths will be related to people who started taking drugs in the 80s and 90s and are now, unfortunately, are dying as a result of drugs.
Ina, thank you very much for coming in with us. Ina Lynch, who's a research officer at the Health Research Board.
Now, legislation changing how judges are appointed in this country passed a crucial Senate stage last night by a razor-thin margin of 25 votes to 23. The vote came after 125 hours of debate over 49 days in the upper house and the liberal use of the filibuster by opponents and an eventual guillotine to end the debate. So what's this all about? Well, the minister whose idea this bill is here, Shane Ross. Good morning.
Good morning, Carol.
Thanks for coming in. Miriam Lord in today's Irish Times describes this as your pet project to remove what you say is cronyism in appointing judges. So as that radio ad says, are we there yet?
We're not quite there, but we're much nearer than we were this time yesterday. We've had to endure a filibuster of 125 hours in the Shannon by the legal lobby, by the lawyers in the Shannon who mainly come down
to. There's been huge opposition to this.
Yeah, it's been led by the lawyers, though. It's been led by the legal lobby in the Sheraton, in the Doyle. And it's been very, very strong indeed. We are now very close to, I think it's going to go back to the Doyle now for the amendments that made in the Shannon. But I think now we're now close to the most fundamental reform in the appointment of judges in the history of the state. And those reforms are really centred around having a lay majority and a lay chair.
So we're talking about people who are non-legal and non-political on this commission that would appoint judges.
Yeah, we're going to have a commission that appoints judges, which will include judges, by the way. It'll include a large number of judges because the expertise is obviously necessary there. But we're going to have a majority of lay people because there has been, unfortunately, since the foundation of the state, political appointments, political interference, political patronage in the appointment of judges. And what we want to do, of course, is the
legal profession and the political classes would object to that. They would say that that hasn't been happening. But is there a backlog of judges waiting to be appointed now? Have you put a stay on it since you came into office waiting for this?
No. There have been backlogs from time to time. There's no backlog of judges at the moment. We don't want to obstruct judges in any way or the appointment of judges. There have been difficulties in appointing some. Because I don't like, and the Independent Alliance does not like, the old system. But we recognise, of course, that we've got to keep appointing judges. No, there's no backlog that I know of. We're appointing them reluctantly because the old system is highly political. But it's full of insiders being appointed. What we want to do is reform it, have a really new independent system which appoints judges in a different way with legal expertise. There's no attempt to remove it. But what we have been so surprised by is the strength of the opponents in the law courts, in the forecourts, and the lawyers in the Shannon to this.
And Senator Michael McDougall said last night that the whole thing has been a waste of time because the government can still bypass any legislation that comes out of this.
That's always been the case. What this is about is who is recommended and how many are recommended to the government. In the past, the government has received maybe up to 40 names, and politicians in the government have been able to select out of those 40 names, people who appear to be closely aligned to them. Now we're going to have a system whereby lay majority and a lay chair are the majority in sending those names up, which will only be three names, and the government will have a very, very limited choice. They'll be chosen on merit and regardless of political affiliation.
And can this be passed by the Dáil, or could it cause an election given the precarious numbers we're looking at now?
No, I don't think it'll cause an election. No, absolutely not. I think it was passed by the Dáil, remember, before. And it was passed by a healthy majority by the Dáil before. After difficulties there, but now the filibuster from the law library is over. I think we'll probably find it goes through the Dáil fairly quickly in January.
Let's change to the FAI here. Are you going to bail out the FAI?
I hate that sort of expression. What we're doing at the moment is we are looking after the 2.9 million. Which we have been giving to the FAI. We've withdrawn that funding, and what we're going to do there is we're going to ensure that gets to the small clubs. We're going to absolutely ensure that gets to the players, to the grassroots, but doesn't go near the FAI, because the FAI bailout is a very pejorative word, but it's a basket case, and to ask the government to come in and bail it out when we don't even know the extent of the black hole there, it's an appalling vista. And to ask us to bail it out, no, that's not going to happen. We want to protect taxpayers' funding, and we also want to protect the grassroots. They're the important people. We're interested in football, not so interested in the FAI.
Daniel McDonnell reporting in the Irish Independent today that there's talk that the FAI could be split into two separate divisions, one that would look after the elite sport, the international team, the other, the grassroots, and that the government would step in to take over this grassroots end of things. Is that something you're looking at?
Well, our interest, as I say, is in football, and I read that in the Irish Times this morning, and I think any constructive ideas which come forward, and I thought this is constructive, full of good people like Brian Kerr and Niall Quinn, who are suggesting it, we look at any suggestion come through, but nobody should look at us as the government is just going to come in and bail out an organisation which is coming to us with a black hole, the extent of which we don't know, which has been doing some extraordinary things which we couldn't stand over. No, we're not going to give them any blank cheque. What we are going to do is we are going to protect that money which we are already putting in, make sure the FAI don't get their hands on it in their present form, but that it goes to the grassroots of soccer. They're the people we're worried about.
Are you in contact with the FAI, speaking with anybody there, or are you keeping a distance because of the Gardaí investigation, etc.?
I haven't been speaking to the FAI for several months, mainly because it's full of the old guard. And because of its governance is still in a situation which is not acceptable
at all. But that will be changing.
When that changes, of course, we look at it again. What we're waiting for and we can't understand why the FAI has been so reluctant to. Where are the independent directors? Where in the name of God are they? Why are they reluctant to do it? What we're looking for is a new independent CEO. Where is that? And we're looking for a new chairman. None of those things have happened. The FAI is reluctant to change. It hasn't been changed. Its board hasn't even been totally cleared out at that stage. To expect us to go in and accept them as a government, we're not going to do that. Not until we see clear signs of reform of corporate governments and new people and a clean out and a total clean out.
Now, another aspect of your brief is road safety, and we hear today that 300 people have been arrested so far in the Christmas road safety campaign, which began just 12 days ago. It looks as if all the messages, your message, the RSA's message, the Gardaí's message, is simply not having the required impact on certain people.
Well, I think you know, 146 deaths this year so far is absolutely tragic, and it's 146 tragedies. Road deaths have come down over a long period. The trend is downwards. It's not satisfactory still, but I have introduced, as you probably know, measures on drunken driving, which have been quite severe. I hope they've kept the numbers down. I am introducing measures on speeding now as well, which will come in the new year as well. We introduce measures on drugs, and we're doing everything we possibly can. Everything is not enough. 146 people is too many.
I think it's 136 so far this year.
136, yeah. Okay. But it's higher than it was last year. It's six higher than it was last year. And it is just not satisfactory. But we'll do absolutely everything we can. It's not acceptable that we have a drink and drug culture still, which tolerates people drinking and driving. I'm delighted that the guards are enforcing. That's tremendous. They're making the arrests. That's tremendous. That should be a deterrent. But it's not acceptable what's happening. It's still far too high.
Minister Shane Ross, thank you for joining us.
250 new social houses have been promised over the next year by the Voluntary Housing Association, Circle VHA. It has entered into a public-private investment arrangement with AIB and financial services group Centrus, worth €51 million. The group says it will build 300 houses a year from 2021 onwards. A court case being taken by the state's investor compensation company has resulted in over 1,000 clients of the collapsed investment firm Custom House Capital facing further delays in receiving compensation. The liquidator to Custom House Capital has been prevented from distributing funds while it seeks legal clarification about an aspect of its statutory powers. Shares in the Saudi state oil firm Aramco have surged for a second consecutive day after its stock market debut yesterday. The company briefly touched its target $2 trillion mark value this morning before the share price fell back slightly. The shares gained the daily permitted maximum of 10% yesterday. Currencies finally, the euro this morning is trading at $1.114 and 84.3 pence sterling.
23 minutes to 9 now on Morning Ireland, and Des is back with sport.
Yeah, good morning, Carl. We're starting with this suggestion of a plan to split the FAI in two, which is being put to the government. The proposal has been devised by some FAI staff members, suggesting the state would fund a new body that would solely govern grassroots and community football, and the FAI would look after the international teams and elite football. The plan suggests the government would provide €10 million to fund grassroots, while the FAI would fund itself through commercial deals. Currently, the government invests just under €3 million on soccer. But on this programme a short time ago, Minister for Sport Shane Ross said they're not going to give a blank cheque to bail out the FAI. The FAI is a basket case, he said. The lineup for the last 16 of the Champions League is now complete after last night's group stage is concluded. Tottenham had already made sure of their place before losing last night 3-1 to Bayern Munich in Germany. They put out pretty much a second string team. Dublin teenager Troy Parrott was named on the bench, but he didn't play. Another newcomer, Ryan Sessegnon, scored the Tottenham goal. They go through in second place from their group. In Group C, Gabriel Jesus hit a hat-trick as Manchester City wrapped up their campaign with a 4-1 win at Dinamo Zagreb. They go through as group winners. Youngster Phil Foden got the fourth goal for City. And City manager Pep Guardiola feels Foden is one of several players who offer England a very bright future.
Now the young players from Chelsea, Mason Mount and the other one, they have quite similar quality, you know, the one against one, small spaces, attacking. So I think England have an incredible generation for the young players. So I think for the next decade, 4 to 8 years, I think England has an incredible, incredible amount of young, young-term players.
Elsewhere, Atlanta secured qualifications in the last 16 despite having lost their first three games in the group. Atalanta, who are competing in the Champions League for the first time, had only 1 point after four games. But last night's 3-0 win at Shakhtar Donetsk caps off a remarkable recovery and is enough to see the Italian side through. In Group D, Atletico Madrid became the last team to qualify when getting the win they needed over Lokomotiv Moscow to make sure of their progress. In England's Women's League Cup, Republic of Ireland captain Katie McCabe scored a hat-trick for Arsenal. They hammered London Bees by 9-0 to make the quarterfinals. Louise Quinn was also on target. In the English Championship, West Brom missed the chance to go back on top of the table. They were held to a 1-1 draw at Wigan. Brentford moved to within a point of the playoff places with a 2-1 win over Cardiff. Now, it's a busy night in the Europa League this evening. Several clubs have already qualified for the knockout stages, including Celtic, who play Cluj, Manchester United, who host AZ Alkmaar, and Wolves at home to Besiktas. Arsenal need to avoid a heavy defeat against Standard Liège to make it through, and Rangers need a draw with the Young Boys of Bern. In rugby, Munster back row Arno Bolter will miss their game at Saracens this weekend after receiving a 3-game ban for his red card in last Saturday's match. Saracens may include some of the big names who did not play in Limerick last weekend, but when speaking with Michael Corcoran about next Saturday's game, Munster centre Rory Scannell played down that aspect.
We have a quality squad across the board. We said last week we were going to concentrate on ourselves, you know, not knowing what type of squad they were going to go with. So, you know, the best thing to do for us is just concentrate on how we can perform. And, you know, there's a few lads will probably return this week, and, you know, they had a strong squad at the weekend, and no doubt they'll be strong again this week. So, from our point of view, we're just concentrating ourselves for the moment.
It is essentially cup final rugby from here on in. I mean, effectively, given how competitive this pool is, you really can't afford to drop a match between now and game six.
Yeah, definitely. You know, it's such a tight group. There'll probably be only one team to get out of it. And, you know, I think we're in the same position we were last year. We're just sitting a point behind Racing this time around. So, you know, as you said, you can't afford to slip up. And, you know, three of the teams are still in the mix to get out of the group. So, you know, we'll have to be at our best come Saturday. There's been times where, you know, we haven't performed in the first leg, as you'd say, in the doubleheader, and, you know, fixed a few things and gone away and performed quite well in the second time round. So, you know, we'll try and hopefully the weather will be a bit better and we'll brush up on a few things from the weekend. Since the start of the season, we've improved massively. You know, our defence has been good and, you know, our attack's improving all the time. So, you know, obviously we couldn't show too much of it at the weekend given the conditions. But, yeah, I think it's definitely going the right direction.
You kept them tryless last week. I mean, not a lot of teams do that. You're going to have to try and do something similar this week.
Yeah, I think so. You know, it's the artificial pitch can make the game a bit quicker, and, you know, they score quite a lot of points at home, and, you know, we'll be trying our best to keep them as low as we can, and, you know, hopefully get a few tries ourselves.
That's Rory Scannell. We finish with golf news and President's Cup rivalry, which has all been buried really for decades because of American dominance. Flicker back to life a bit at Royal Melbourne this morning. The unfancied internationals have taken a 4-1 lead. They hammered Tiger Woods United States in the four balls matches. Tiger Woods and Justin Thomas provided the only point for the US. For the latest in sport, check out the RTE News Now app and RTE.ie.
Let's go to London now, where voting has been underway for over an hour and a half in the UK general election, the country's third in less than 5 years and the first in December in almost a century. Polls close at 10 tonight. Counting starts immediately afterwards, as does our coverage across RTE. Morning Ireland will be in Belfast and London from 6 a.m. tomorrow. Our reporter Dermot Fleming is already in London. Where exactly are you, Dermot?
I'm at Vauxhall, which is a constituency as near as you can get to Westminster itself. The MP here for 30 years was Kate Hoey from County Antrim, but she's not standing again. She's a Labour MP, but in a way reflecting the great divisions there are in this country now, she was very much in favour of Brexit, voted against her party, and she's not standing again. Now, there's been a steady trickle of people coming here. I've been talking to some of them, given the fact that Kate Hoey is from Northern Ireland, was asking them too as regards how central Northern Ireland was to the whole Brexit debacle, if you like, here, or the Brexit crisis. How much of an issue was it to them in the election? And they were polite in saying, yes, we know it's important, but in essence, it's still an election. You feel that Northern Ireland is far away, an election where it's local issues that are consuming people here. Brexit is the central issue, it seems, according to those I was talking to this morning, but also public services like the NHS as well.
Do people look happy to be voting in December?
No, everybody I spoke to is basically saying a plague on all their houses. There's a feeling that there's complete political paralysis here, and they feel we need to vote to get something moving. Whether it's Brexit or whether it's staying in, we need some decision, some movement. One guy I was talking to here, he's a project manager. He said, I work in construction. Loads of my projects are on hold because investors just don't know what to do as regards what's going to happen in Britain because of Brexit. So it's not just the political paralysis you have here, if you like, it's also affecting people in terms of their jobs as well.
Dermot, what sort of age group are the people that you're seeing voting this morning?
Mostly in their 30s and 40s. I was asking, were they voting because of their enthusiasm? That's why they're voting so early. And they said, well, no, it's because of work and we have stuff to do later on. So people in their 30s and 40s. It makes it a lot busier than I thought. I didn't expect to be too many here because it's extremely cold. There's a very bad weather forecast for most of Britain, which may have an impact on the... It's likely to have some kind of an impact on the numbers who go voting. But at the same time, there's a feeling that this is a really critical election. This is much more critical than even, you know, all elections are important, but than any in recent memory, really, that the country is at a crossroads, and there's a feeling of duty on the part of those I saw this morning to come out to exercise their franchise, to exercise their vote.
If you were a reporter flying into Ireland on the day of a general election, it would be very hard to avoid it with all the posters all over the place. Do you get a sense that there is an election on when you arrive there?
Very good question. No, and I did think that coming in yesterday. It's much more muted. There might be a sense of fatigue in that this has been a long campaign at a time of year when people have got their minds on Christmas or the expenses involved in Christmas. But when you come in here, there's a feeling of, I think, fatigue amongst people. This, in effect, has really been a three-year campaign. I know it's gone on for the last few weeks, quite a long campaign since it was announced by Johnson. But the feeling that it's gone on since the Brexit referendum, that this is the overarching issue, and people are just thinking, let's get Parliament working again. They're saying to me this morning that they feel there's complete political paralysis, and that has big impact, obviously, on the whole country.
Dermot Fleming in London, thank you. Full coverage across RTE from 10 p.m. this evening. We'll be in London and Belfast at the earlier time of 6 a.m. tomorrow.
And a retired Garda who's been questioned in connection with immigration irregularities in the old Garda Western Division remains in custody this morning. Our Midlands correspondent Kieran Mullooly is on the story. Kieran, what do you know about this?
Carol, this is an extensive Garda investigation that's been going on now for over 2 years, and it is an inquiry which has very, very serious implications. The Garda are investigating an allegation, which basically at the centre of this allegation is that individuals were coming to a Garda station in the west of Ireland in the course of their application for immigration papers and processing here. They would have been coming in on a regular basis seeking the assistance of a Garda and asking that certain forms would be identified and would be stamped or countersigned. Now, the allegation the Garda are investigating is that money was changing hands in this process. And secondly, another allegation is that another individual, a third party, a gentleman from Pakistan, was also involved in the procedure and was also receiving cash payments as a result of the process whereby the signs were actually stamped or countersigned. Now, for the Garda, once this allegation came to light, a process began, a trawl, I believe, to hundreds and hundreds of applications made at the Garda station in the west of Ireland. And this has been a lengthy process, and it's been a painstaking process for the Garda, trying to locate people, trying to go back on paperwork and trying to establish the identification of people and the location of people at this point. Now, it was in the course of this work that the arrest was made yesterday, and I gather there will be further arrests over the course of the coming weeks in regard to this inquiry. As I say, the implications are very, very serious in this situation, not only from the perspective of the allegation that a Garda or another person was receiving money as a result of the process, but secondly, and more importantly, that individuals were receiving stamps and countersigns and verification from a Garda or from an office where Garda was based, and people that were not known to the Garda and perhaps are still not known to the Garda. People who may have come into the country at very short notice on other visas, on student visas or otherwise, and may have not have the appropriate identification, yet may have received countersigning. So very, very serious allegations. And I understand that the cover yesterday's investigation continues. The Garda, who's in his 60s, is still in custody. His detention was extended overnight, and he must be released or charged later today.
Okay, I'm sure you'll be following that throughout the day. Our Midlands correspondent there, Kieran Mullooly.
Former naval service ship sold to Libyans involved in war. That's the front page headline on the Irish Times this morning. Colm Keane has the story. Colm, tell us more.
Yeah, there's a new report out. An expert panel on Libya has submitted a report to the UN Council, Security Council, and it traces the ownership of the Ellie Ashling since it was sold by the state in March of 2017. The ship then went to a shipping broker. It was bought by a shipping broker in Holland, and Dick van der Kemp's ship sales, and that company sold it to a company in the United Arab Emirates called Universal Satcom Services, and it in turn sold it to a company in Libya, and is now under the ownership of this man called Khalifa Haftar, who's involved in the civil war over there. Now, the sale by the company in the United Arab Emirates was a breach of the arms embargo on sales to Libya, according to this expert panel. Interestingly, they trace the ownership and all the deals involved. So the Irish state sold it for 110,000, and by the time the company in Libya was buying it, it was the price was $1.5 million or €1.3 million. The ship had been decommissioned before it was sold by the state, but it's now been rearmed with the kind of cannons and so on that were on the ship originally. And, you know, so obviously it's available to this man who's described as a warlord and is involved in this war in Libya.
Once the Irish state had sold the ship, its obligations ended, though, didn't it?
Yeah, we spoke to a spokeswoman from the Department of Defence, and she said, well, they had no obligation to follow what happened to the ship after they'd sold it. They'd sold it to this shipping broker in Holland, and that was the end of their control over the okay. What happened to it.
Colm, thank you. That's Colm Keane, legal affairs correspondent with the Irish Times.
Do you want your old turkey washed down? The answer is you don't. A new report says half of us are not preparing our turkey correctly. Well, let's find out why. Dr. Linda Gordon is the chief specialist in food science with Safe Food, and she's in our Cork studio. Good morning, Linda.
Good morning, Carol.
So 4 in 10 people are washing their turkey while preparing it. Tell us why they should not be doing that.
Well, washing turkey under a tap in your kitchen will just spread food poisoning bacteria around your kitchen in tiny droplets that you won't even be able to see. And there's no need to wash it. Any bacteria will be killed when the turkey is cooked. So we're asking people not to wash their turkeys.
How dangerous is the bacteria from turkey? We're always told that poultry is extremely dangerous. What kind of illnesses can you get if it happens to spread to other foods that you're preparing?
I suppose the most common one associated with poultry is Campylobacter, and that is the most common form of bacterial foodborne illness, and it particularly affects young children. So those under 5 are particularly affected, and also older people as well. So, you know, just think about the more vulnerable members of your family if you're thinking about washing your turkey, and also think about what's either side of your sink. You know, bacteria can spread up to about an arm's length, around 80 centimetres either side of your sink. So just think about what's in your splash zone, as we call it, and just don't do it, please.
And of course, 1 in 4 people will be cooking the turkey for the first time. So you're particularly aiming this at those people who have not done it before and may not know.
Yes, exactly. A lot of people, you know, will be doing it for the first time this year, or maybe they don't cook, you know, whole turkeys or whole, you know, joints of meat very often. So we have a lot of information, not just about washing the turkey, but everything you need to know about cooking and preparing the Christmas dinner on our website. And we're really aiming it, I suppose, mostly at those people who are maybe a bit less confident. We have a calculator where you can put in the weight of your turkey if you have a fan oven, whether it's stuffed or unstuffed, and it will tell you how long to cook it for.
And what about that argument, stuffing inside or stuffing outside? outside. I always put mine inside, but you say it's probably better out.
It's better out unless you have an electric fan oven, because otherwise you can end up with the stuffing undercooked while the meat is cooked, and you don't want to overcook the meat. So our research shows that it is safe to do it if you have an electric fan oven, but you should take into account the weight of the stuffing when you're working out how long to cook your turkey for.
You also find that almost 60% of people are leaving their turkey out of the fridge, sometimes overnight, mistakenly thinking that this is the safest way to store the food.
Yes, and I mean, fridge space is at a premium, I suppose, around Christmas time. But if you do a little bit of planning ahead, move around the shelves in your fridge and do make sure that you've space for the turkey. If you don't have space to put it back in the fridge after it's been cooked, and it should, all the leftovers should go in within 2 hours of cooking. But you could carve it up, and store it that way. But we would definitely don't leave it out. You know, we want to make the most of our leftovers. We don't want them going off. We have 3 days, if we are storing them in the fridge, in which it's safe to use them. So we do want to make the most of them. So always best to store in the fridge.
And what about making turkey curry? Can you freeze that and use it whenever you want?
Absolutely. If you don't think you're going to use your leftovers up within the 3 days, put it in the freezer and then you can use it whenever you want. But make sure it's sealed or wrapped up well, so that the quality of the meat will be maintained.
Is there a lot of sickness relating to turkey or poultry bacteria around this time of year?
Well, it's very difficult to, sort of attribute directly illness with, particular practices and things at times of year. We do know that, Christmas is a time when people are under pressure, and we know when people are distracted and under pressure and busy, that's when we tend to maybe take some shortcuts in the home. And we also tend to attribute food poisoning to, something we ate outside the home. And we don't always realise that sometimes it's some of our practices in the home. So things like avoiding cross-contamination, hand washing, washing all your utensils and surfaces and things like that can really help to protect your family.
Okay, Dr. Linda Gordon, Chief Specialist with Food Science with Safe Food. Thank you very much for that information. It is now 2 minutes to 9.